You are listening to the Marilyn Manson Cases Podcast, the podcast discussing the accusations, lawsuits, and legal news surrounding shock rocker Marilyn Manson. Please note topics include allegations of abuse, some may find disturbing.
Hey everyone, this is Lisa from themansoncases.com, and welcome to the next episode of the Marilyn Manson Cases Podcast. Today, I will be discussing some recent updates in the past few weeks related to the lawsuits, as well as briefly discuss an interesting development related to what appears to be a PR spin related to Evan Rachel Wood's custody, where it is alleged she, quote, gave up her son because of alleged threats made by Marilyn Manson. But first, a brief update in Marilyn Manson's lawsuit against Evan Rachel Wood and Ashley Ilmagore. Both Evan and Ilma have filed their answers to Marilyn Manson's lawsuit. If you don't understand what that means, then let me explain real quick. When someone files a lawsuit, the person or persons being sued has to file a response to that lawsuit. In this case, both Evan and Ilma first responded to the lawsuit by using the anti-slap statute, claiming they had First Amendment protections. Well, now that the court has ruled on the anti-slap, both Evan and Ilma still had to file their answer to the lawsuit, and the answer is basically their defense against Manson's lawsuit. For example, Evan responded with 24 different defenses to the lawsuit. And while it's normal for these responses to be short and brief, from my understanding, having as much as 24 defenses is a bit unusual. But considering she wants to get out of this lawsuit, it's completely expected. When I spoke to attorney Andrea Burkhart, her opinion was something to the effect that these women would likely not get removed from the lawsuit this far in the game. There is also the matter of an appeal pending from Marilyn Manson's legal team. As a reminder, they have up to 60 days to file an appeal once the judge's orders post, which it has. So far, right now, everything is business as usual. So I'm not going to spend time going through every defense that Evan and Ilma are claiming. Just know that it was filed as expected, and we will see what happens moving forward. In Ashley Walter's appeal, things are still moving forward in the appeal process. In fact, we are close to a year when this appeal was first filed, and there was a brief due sometime this summer, which I did end up speaking to Steve of Southern Law about, as I had a lot of questions surrounding this brief, because I have not been able to access any of these documents in the appeal, so I can't review and really give a more thorough discussion surrounding it. However, I am including a discussion I had with Steve on Colonel Kurt's YouTube channel about 2 to 3 weeks ago, where we speak about Walter's appeal, so look forward to that later in this podcast episode. And finally, in Bianca Kine's lawsuit against Marilyn Manson, we have some updates. If you recall, this lawsuit was first filed in New York State Court, then sent to federal court, and now it is back to New York State Court. After Bianca Kine amended her lawsuit back in April to include her legal name, we now have this response from Manson's attorney, Howard King. Largely, he is arguing the majority of her lawsuit should be stricken as it relates to time-barred claims which have since expired, basically that's the statute of limitations, claims of being a minor, as the statute she is suing Manson in New York is only for adults, and the removal of salacious and prejudicial claims. From talking to Steve of Southern Law, it sounds like Howard Keane made good sound arguments. So I speculate, based on this conversation, that these items will likely be removed based on these being good arguments. For now, we await a response from Bianca Kine's attorneys. I also spoke to Steve about this on Colonel Kurt's YouTube channel a few weeks ago, specifically as it relates to when we might see the record companies get served and respond, as that is something we are still waiting on. So make sure to stay tuned, as that is part of this episode as well. The big news in the past few days comes from a, quote, exclusive giving to some largely unknown website called The Blast. I guess it's like a low-level TMZ website, and when I looked into it, they get about 500,000 page views a month, or at least hits, from Google. So in comparison to TMZ or People, it's nowhere near the level of getting millions upon millions of views a day, which is strange. But this article details receiving exclusive documentation from Evan Rachel Wood's ongoing custody battle with Jamie Bell. And the article alleges in the title and in the article itself that Evan gave up custody of her son because of alleged threats made by Marilyn Manson. The title of this article is, quote, Evan Rachel Wood gives up custody of son after alleged Marilyn Manson threats. Pretty direct. So let me offer my perspective on this. First, the article says nothing to prove Evan Rachel Wood, quote, gave up her kid. In fact, it appears from this article, her or her team just outed her as losing custody of her son because these child custody documents in California are confidential. Meaning me, you, a journalist, has zero access to this information unless it is leaked. In the first two paragraphs of this article, for example, it details only a custody arrangement. Quote, according to new legal documents obtained by The Blast, the actress and her ex-boyfriend, Jamie Bell, have agreed to have their 7-year-old son live with his father in Los Angeles. Wood resides in Nashville, Tennessee, and has been battling to keep her son out of LA. In the filing, Wood and Bell agree their son will primarily live with him in Los Angeles. Wood shall have custody of Jack one extended weekend per month from Friday after school or 10 a.m. In other words, the young boy will stay with his dad most of the time in L.A. and travel to see his mom once a month. Of course, she will have custody of him for holidays like spring break and President's Day weekend, but it's a huge change for the actress, so why would she agree to this? From there, the rest of the article hashes out old details to make her point, which is that Evan, quote, gave up custody because of Marilyn Manson. But in those two short paragraphs with this information, there's nothing detailing specifically or quoting from those documents that Evan actually gave up custody voluntarily. In fact, it sounds like Evan or her team outed her for losing custody and is responding to public discussion on social media, which was first brought up by YouTuber Colonel Kurtz, detailing sources saying she lost custody of her son. The rest of the article just rehashes old public documents from early 2021 in the state of Tennessee, not California, before the case was moved to California as a jurisdictional issue. So in this episode, I'm not going to go into every detail or rehash the custody battle. It would take quite a while and would probably be its own series. But know that a few of the articles that came out from this exclusive were largely rehashing this information. And shockingly enough, it was largely not picked up by mainstream media like we would expect. You know, Yahoo and Daily Mail are one thing, right? But we did not see this type of pickup in Rolling Stone, People Magazine, TMZ, you know, generally the large places with large platforms, right? But to me, I suspect it is because no one else took her claim seriously. Because even though some of these bigger places largely get it wrong sometimes, right? As in the case with the Marilyn Manson allegations, because they don't look into anything, well, her or her PR team would have to show what she is alleging is true, that she gave up her kid. And that's just not what I'm seeing it says there. From what I've seen, it just has this appearance of Evan getting ahead of the story because Colonel Kurtz has sources confirming this information that she lost her child. And then others like myself and Marilyn Manson Uncanceled have started to discuss this on social media. But her or her PR team or whoever leaked these documents for her benefit, well, it appears it backfires. Because by the next day, Marilyn Manson is fighting back with exclusive quotes in the Daily Mail and in Fox News from sources close to him, which is something we have not seen before this, even when the allegations first came out in the media. In the Daily Mail, a source close to Marilyn Manson says, quote, Brian Warner has not had any contact nor communications of any kind with Evan Rachel Wood in nearly a decade. At no time has Brian Warner ever threatened Ms. Wood or her family. Wood has not provided a shred of evidence of Warner making any threats against her or her family. Wood continues to make unproven claims publicly and to the court based on a fraudulent FBI letter that was created and written by her and her accomplice, Ilma Gore, during their coordinated attack on Warner. In his own declaration to the court in his custody battle, Mr. Bell has said that Evan's story defies credibility. The only people whose safety has been threatened are Warner and his wife, Lindsay Usage, who were swatted at their home based on a duplicitous phone call made to the FBI by Ilma Gore, who claimed to be a friend of the couple. DailyMail.com has contacted Wood's representatives for further comment. And as of the time I am recording this, Evan Rachel Wood's legal team, PR, whatever, what have you, has not responded to any of these articles, okay? And as of today, there appears to be, from Fox News, a source close to Manson says, quote, Evan is blaming Manson to cover up the fact that she's an unfit mother. She didn't give up custody. She lost it and it has nothing to do with Manson. So recently I did my first YouTube live and I had Colonel Kurtz come on so we could discuss some of the latest in the Marilyn Manson cases to include this new update with Evan Rachel Wood and the response in the media. And so I'm going to play a clip here of that, followed by my discussion with Steve of Southern Law I had about 2 or 3 weeks ago, where we discussed some things such as Bianca Kine's lawsuits and updates we're waiting on for that, as well as Ashley Walters and some other things. So take a listen.
Like I said in my video that I felt like one factor in Evan Rachel Wood like freaking out and doing this dumb thing that is just continued to look dumber now. I mean, because it's given Manson this huge opening and now he's getting a forum like with Fox News is, mm-hmm. you know, doing an article now, putting the truth out there, Jamie Bell. And so like anyway, the point is she made a huge mistake and I was just trying to figure out why. And it seems like I was like, what's changed or what's different that would make her suddenly come out and do this crazy thing and disclose that she basically, you know, she lost custody of her kid. And I thought, well, the only thing that's changed is, you know, Marilyn Manson came out defiantly on his Instagram and Twitter and said he had music coming out. Mm-hmm. And then some of us were saying that other people were amplifying it that I'd heard that she had lost custody and I believed that she had from reputable sources. So I just really think like I'm not trying to give us a ton of credit or whatever, but I really do think that we may have driven her crazy into making a big error. I have had some people, and it's not me complaining, all right, but I'm just saying that some people express that they wish at times that I were like nicer. I mean, nicer in terms of like less aggressive, how I present myself and whatever. And the thing is like, that's not what we're battling against. I mean, collectively, those of us who are fighting for and supporting the truth here, this is a massive hoax by some like deeply disturbed, pathological, diabolical people who are willing to stop at nothing and, you know, use like almost any means necessary to get what they want. Then that's, you know, I kind of feel like it's sort of all's fair in love and war. And so Fox News, whoever wrote this, I think they were doing a good job of trying to get attention here. It says, shock rocker not to blame in Evan Rachel Wood custody battle, X says, that's Jamie Bell, X says, and then quote, nothing to do with Marilyn Manson. And so anyway, it's not factually incorrect, but it's just that the connotation of it is that Jamie Bell like came out today and he was speaking out, which he wasn't. This is court documents. Nevertheless, it was great. Kudos to them. I think it was effective to do that. And the article was great. Like finally, someone, whatever people think of Fox News, but finally, like someone is actually trying to report some stuff here. And it's not just the Daily Mail, but, Jamie Bell cannot be pleased that mm-hmm. Evan Rachel Wood is resurrecting the story and giving this new life. Like, I understand that I'm sure Jamie Bell, to the extent he's aware of me, and maybe that's not at all, but to the extent of which he's aware of me, I'm sure he's not pleased with me either. And I'm sorry. Look, I'm going to say this. I do hate that this whole situation is what it is, to where these are the only sort of tools that are available to us to show the evil that this woman is perpetrating on an innocent man, is to have to dredge up stuff from the past that I'm sure Jamie Bell would rather stay buried to try mm-hmm. to expose her character. But you know what? The world is rough. That's how it is. And sorry, but my ability to dredge up stuff and your ability and the ability of others, it is minuscule. It is minuscule compared to Evan Rachel Wood's ability, as we've seen, to now get all this stuff whipped up and get people interested again in this or for the first time. And so Jamie Bell cannot be happy that she is using, again, she's using her child as a pawn. That's basically what this comes down to, is she's using her own child in a pawn, because you would think that she would want to keep any mention of her child out of this. If you really care about your kid's safety and that's your ultimate concern, I don't think you'd even want to be announcing that you had given up custody. Why are you announcing to Marilyn Manson where he needs to go to get your kid? I mean, my God, it just now occurred to me. I'm like, my God, you've just come out and you've confirmed for everyone that your kid is not living with you and moreover is now living in LA.
You know, that brings up a good point too. And maybe we should talk about this because I don't know about you, but have you seen maybe some people complaining that we talk about the custody at all? My purpose of looking and wanting to say report on them has to do with proving and showing that she has a history of lying and not being good on the stand. I'm not looking to post pictures of her kid, which, mind you, they are blurred anyways in the photos.
Well, you don't have to. She's already posted pictures of me. I know the back of his head at least, right?
But you know what I mean? Like, we're not looking to dox this woman, where she lives.
I don't like talking about it. It actually really, like, it does make me feel icky. And it's sort of like, look, I mean, I hate to, like, I don't want to reference Apocalypse Now and get everybody out of, like, what we're talking about. But, like, that's one of the main things that, like, Colonel Kurtz says in Apocalypse Now in the movie. He's like, when you're fighting a war, you have to do things at times that don't make you feel great. Mm-hmm. And, we're fighting a media war. I'm not trying to get, like, megalomaniacal and say, oh, my God, it's all about my channel. But I'm just saying, all of us collectively, there is an evil, disturbed, pathological woman who is relentlessly, like some kind of Terminator, going after this guy, and she will not stop. Like, she is like, at the end, that movie when it's just like, it's now like reduced to like metal, and it's just still like, like, I feel like that we're gonna get eventually with her. Oh my God.
Well, and the way I also like to explain this to someone who might not be happy, or maybe they don't understand why we do talk about this, I'm like, listen, we're not the ones that brought this out there. We didn't put it in the Daily Mail or publicly available documents.
Everything that's happened, she's brought upon herself. Now, I understand there's unfortunately there's an innocent child involved. Mm-hmm. Who didn't bring any of this on him, it's like, that's one of the tough things of the world, is that whatever family you're born into, you're going to basically be stuck with your parents' problems. You're going to be trying to get out from under them. And that poor kid, I'm sure that the rest of his life, to some extent, is going to be spent, psychologically speaking, trying to get out from under all the pathologies that his mom has been trying to implant in his brain. I mean, it's really sad,
Yeah. And I urge people to look at the custody documents whenever we post the links, because they are a story worth seeing, because you learn quite a bit. And she even tried to use that against Jamie Bell, saying, well, we didn't know this was going on, which obviously she did if she was attending mediation.
She didn't know that Jamie Bell would like to see his child at some point.
Oh, so this is what I think when cornered, we know that when cornered, she cannot contain herself. We've seen on The View.
Yeah.
She can, and she looks obviously guilty.
Starts the neck scratch. I just want to see the neck scratching again. Can we? I don't know, like, how can we get her on camera and, like, worked up so that all of that? I've just never seen anything like that. I mean, that was almost like a tick that, like, a, I don't know, meth head or something would have. No offense to meth heads, by comparing them to Ed and Rachel. I don't know.
Well, it just, to me, it wasn't even the neck scratch that I paid attention to. It was her. She couldn't even look at them when they were asking or saying anything. That to me is kind of like, when someone's nervous in front of you, or is just, I couldn't even tell if she was really pissed or, you know what I'm saying?
Like, she was pissed at one point that she was having to even answer their questions. Before on The View, they even confronted her about the lawsuit. She got miffed and she was like, well, I don't even have to answer these questions. It's like, lady, why would you, this was your wish, not ours, lady. You're the one who's out here trying to promote your story. Now you're going to get here and you're going to, in true narcissistic fashion, you're going to get upset that we're asking for details. Like, what did you think? She just wants people to give her a platform and then just basically, like, gush all over her like stupid Drew Barrymore, AJ said we should pack a bag and go find her, talk to her. Like our version of, like, Project Veritas. I thought about going by Jay Elwanger's office.
Your boyfriend?
My boyfriend. But Esme Bianco and Ashley Smithline's former attorney. I guess Esme's former or current, I don't know. But I thought, and I was just going to go, like, literally, I was thinking it'd be funny just to go in and, like, ask the receptionist if Jay was around. And, I mean, just, like, dump, but anyway, and so, but then I thought, no, I mean, next thing you know, people will be accusing me of stalking.
They probably would. I mean, they like to twist those documents.
Probably have Texas police coming to my door. Jay Elwanger's, he's upset. He's worried. I'm trying to finish this thumbnail actually right now. That's why I keep clicking pictures. I'm running, my big challenge with the, with the thumbnails is that I'm running out of like pictures of Evan Rachel Wood where she looks constipated or pissed off. You know,
you can always recycle or reuse.
Is there something like there's a worm in her heart, or there's something wrong with her to where she just destroys herself? And I know she may think that when she started all this, that she was going to be destroying Marilyn Manson and she was going to be helping herself. But I think there's some kind of unconscious self-destructive thing going on, because on some level, everybody has to know that if you go down this road of like utter deceit and lies and ruining people and getting other people to get involved in your evil with you and all, like there's some kind of karma at some point that's going to kick in. It's like I said today on the Twitter Spaces thing that I did. I don't know, you know, about God and morality and all of that. Like, I have ideas. I don't have any special knowledge, but like, I just don't think that the universe will allow you to just persistently keep going deeper and deeper into the muck. Like she has the moral and ethical and spiritual muck and do these horrible things to people and all of this. And there, and she's not going to hit a wall at some point. Like at some point she is going to hit a wall. Mm-hmm. And the universe is just going to say, no more. And I think that maybe that's kind of what's starting to happen here. And maybe that's why she's starting to freak out, is because I think she probably had some hope, or a great deal of hope maybe, that when Marilyn Manson, Brian Warner's lawsuit, when the defamation part of it was struck, and when he got them, because it was an expected ruling, and when he got this bad ruling, this negative ruling, I think that she hoped that that would be like the end. And I don't know, like he would just go away, or he would be, you know, he would be put in his place, so to speak, or cowed. But then his response to that was sort of like, okay, never mind, fuck you, I'm coming out with new music, I'm hanging out with people, I'm here, right? I'm going to be here. And I don't know, that maybe plus us talking about her losing her kid tipped her into this.
So the New York case, you know, it started in state court and then it went to federal court, and it was a little bit of a mystery there and stuff. But, you know, I saw a hole in it and I thought, well, this may come back. And there actually was another hole in it, and it came back to state court, which that's not bad for Manson, right? I mean, that's fine that it comes back down, because it could go back up again, because the court basically said, you need to show us the amount in controversy is over $75,000. But the hole I didn't mention was the one where they said you got to have the other defendant's consent. Right.
Okay. Now,
if he does want to come back up, I don't know why they wouldn't do that. But I haven't seen any really movement on it. I think they filed something for the amended service, amended process, and amended complaint with her real name in it.
Yeah, I saw the amended complaint, because with the amended process, is that related to when the record companies and everyone has to file? Because I haven't seen anything.
I didn't look at it, but sometimes a summons will, you know, and I'm not sure how they do it up there, but like if a summons gets too old, you have to get them to issue you a new one. And they might have just issued out a new one with her real name in it and starts the time period. Because like ours are only good for 30 days, or maybe it's 60. I don't remember. Let's say it's 30 or 60, because I can't remember right now. Anyway, it's a limited period of time, and you either have to get it extended or you have to get a new one. And you can't, because you can't serve an expired summons on somebody and it doesn't count.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, because I'm like, I keep refreshing the page, like, come on, hurry up. It's the slowest lawsuit so far. Well, in Jane Doe in California, we really don't see much going on, you know, at least in terms of filings, because I'm sure things must be going smoothly behind the scenes then.
Well, nothing anyway to get mad enough to like file a sanctions motion against each other. So that is good.
All right. I got it fixed. And then, it looked like they just blocked the one that I already did part one, which I expected, like, because I use some copyrighted material and stuff. So this one is still, I mean, everybody, people are watching, so it can't be, blocked. You know what, Anna? It's not so much, I'm actually not as sleepy as you would think. What's getting me right now, I don't know how many of you know this, but our air conditioning broke yesterday. And so I found, and it was funny because it was funny. It's not like it's oppressively horribly hot, but it's in the 70s here. So, you know, it's warm. And it's funny because I was going to do this live stream, and like on his way out, my guy was like, you know, by the way, it's going to be kind of warm. The guy can't come until Monday. He's like, but you know, there's not a whole lot you have to do, right? And I'm thinking, I've got this live stream from midnight to midnight, you know, 24 hours, and I'm going to be burning up. So that's the main thing. I'm just kind of hot. I think what I'm going to do, y'all can keep talking a little bit. I think I'm actually going to take a break. I have an interview coming on at 7. So right now it's 5:50 my time. I have an interview coming on at 7 with Vanessa, and also I think Paula's going to be coming in. And so I think I might break and take a cold shower. And I think hopefully that will help. But so anyway, what I'm going to do, if you want to talk some more, I'll leave you on the stream and I'll come back in a bit. No pressure, but I think I'm going to do that. And Steve, thanks for being on here. And I'm going to be listening to you. So if you do want to finish up, then I'll put something else on. But y'all finish talking, and then I'll be back, everybody, with some cool interviews at 7 Central. Okay. All right. Leave you too. Thanks.
So Lisa, you were saying about some of the California cases?
Oh, I can't remember about the California case. Yeah. I was looking at Ashley Walters, update the other day, and I got to look at my messages. I think I sent it to you. What does it mean when they're waiting for an appellate brief? I think it's the wording. Let me pull it up real quick. It said appellant's reply brief is due July 7th.
So the appellant will file the appeal and say, hey, here's why the trial court was wrong. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have the other side file their response brief and say, no, the judge was correct. Oh, my God. That'd be Manson's side. Right. Mm-hmm. So Walters files the appeal and files a brief saying, here's what was wrong. Then Manson files a brief saying, no, actually, it was totally good. Then she gets to file a shorter reply brief, typically. Kind of like at the trial court where you have a brief and a counter brief. And then a lot of times you can file a reply, not all the time, but sometimes. And so that's probably what that is a reply. I tried to get the briefs, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah. So my understanding, right, that would that specifically be something they both have to reply to?
No, and in theory, she's already told the court, hey, here's why this decision should be overturned. Mm-hmm. And then he said, no, the decision's totally good. And this should be just, usually the rule is, you know, like you have, say, 50 pages for your main brief, 50 mm-hmm. pages for the response, and then replies, like, say, 10 pages, where you just get, to, if, you know, if Manson brought up a point that she didn't think about, she gets to at least reply to it. That's usually all a reply brief is.
Okay, that makes sense. So my other question was, and I feel like maybe you wouldn't know this because it's California and it's the weird, funky, you know, law right now where you can file from claims from like 2009 to 2011. But her lawsuit was dismissed, if I recall, for not only the statute of limitations, but because the judge said that while she realized at the time that this was supposed abuse or whatnot and couldn't overcome discovery or not discovery. The word escapes me. I'm already getting tired myself. but basically, cause she claimed the repressed memory thing. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, the judge was saying, look, you actually knew what happened at the time. You just didn't do anything. How would that affect an appeal, especially something like this, if the judge says that as well? It's not just the statute of limitations.
Well, that kind of is, because so you have the statute of limitations, and then the statute of limitations could be told, mm-hmm. which is delayed or, you know, not applied for the period of time in which hypothetically you didn't know about it. Mm. So since the statute of limitations had run, she was trying to get it, the judge to say, I agree that it's told for this period because it was repressed or whatever. But that mm-hmm. judge said, look, the facts that you've alleged to me don't legally mean that this could be told. Okay. Because you knew mm-hmm. about it. And I think, you know, some difference between knowing it happened and knowing you had an injury and all that. The judge didn't buy it. So normally she'd be constrained in the appeal to say, hey, the judge is wrong. Look at this case. Look at this case. The facts that I allege are enough to at least get the case to go forward. Mm-hmm. However, I think she's got the benefit here that they've changed the law out there to basically let you sue back to infinity with no repression. And what happens is, at least the way I read it, I'm not a California lawyer, but the way I read it is that statute is retroactive for a case that is still pending. If it hadn't been finally adjudicated, if she kept it pending by filing the appeal, okay, because it's not considered done until the appeal's over. Okay. So if a case had already been adjudicated fully, then the statute doesn't say you get just file a new lawsuit if you already filed one and it was gone. Mm-hmm. But if it was still in process when the statute was passed, or if you hadn't brought it at all, then the new statute of limitations would apply. So I did find a case out there where a statute of limitations changed during an appeal period, and the court said, yeah, it's changed now. And since this case is still pending, we're going to let this case move forward now because the law changed. So it's kind of weird, and it doesn't have to be that way. But my understanding of their law out there is that that is how they interpret it. So to my mind, she would be successful on her appeal. But that's just, you know, I spent a little bit of time researching what is really a complicated appeal issue. So I would have loved to seen the briefs that they both had to see what his arguments against it were, because I thought she had the better legal argument there.
Gotcha. So basically, if I understand it correctly, if she didn't appeal and it was gone, she wouldn't be able to then be in this appeal process.
Yeah,
or file another lawsuit, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So if her case had been dismissed with prejudice, say, 2 years ago, and she let it go, and then they passed this retroactive thing, she couldn't come back on the same set of facts, same tort,
and bring a new suit up.
But as long as she kept it pending, then in theory, the new statute of limitations would retroactively benefit her in this case and remove that obstacle for her. So as weird as it is, because I don't think it has to be that way, I think she would be successful there. Off of what I saw, I still would, you know, I would say with a big caveat is they both briefed this and I haven't seen their arguments. So I don't know what she said and I don't know what he said. Just guessing.
I know. That's what sucks about the appeal so far, is we can't see what's going on. We can see like when things are due, but, you know, that doesn't really tell us too much, except it looks like, let's see, it's due July 7th. It's coming on a year since that appeal was filed.
Yeah.
In late July.
Isn't that crazy?
Such a long time. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, what about the anti-slaps?
Yeah, I was guessing a year for that, but you know, this thing has been out there forever.
Yeah, and I think both sides missed deadlines, and I think they kind of didn't help either.
That's weird. And I still, in my mind, there's no way the lawyer's going to miss the deadline unless they just don't mean to prosecute the appeal. So I really wonder if it's how they report it on the court's website somehow. Because I think that didn't they say Manson missed it too?
Yeah, and that was kind of weird. And I'm like, I thought one side was okay, whatever, maybe wanted to let it go, and then they filed something, but then it happened on Manson's side, and I think it happened twice on Manson's side consecutively.
Yeah, so my guess is they weren't missing the deadlines, but the way that it reports up on the website made it look that way to us, because I don't even see one attorney doing that, and much less two.
Yeah, that seems statistically odd.
Yeah.
And I'm not an attorney. It's just from what I've heard.
Well, I mean, it's malpractice to do that. So I don't think it happened. So I thought when we thought it expired, it either meant they decided to drop the appeal or they'd settled it or something, because I don't think either one of them would actually miss these deadlines. That's crazy.
Now, I had a question, and I don't think I spoke to you about this, but I spoke to Andrea privately because I was curious about Ashley Walters' deposition that was done in Esme Bianco's case, because now that lawsuit settled, so we're not going to see that. However, could they use that deposition for, let's say, Walters if that comes back?
Well, it's interesting in terms of using it in her own case, because I think there was a confidentiality order in the Bianco case, and that usually will have a provision in it against using the information that you got in that case in some other litigation, right? And that's a continuing obligation after the case is over. So it will have some terms in it of, here's what happens to all the private information that we agreed to deal with during a case. And so my guess is probably they can't use it, because I don't remember the terms of the order, but I think it probably would say you can't do that.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to be able to potentially do it, then you should file some motion with the court and object to this being confidential or whatever. Now, that's not to say that potentially Manson couldn't go through a procedure at some point to try to do that. But I don't think you could just fire it up there. In other words, if he couldn't do it when the case was active because of the confidentiality order, he probably still couldn't do it after it's over, unless he got the court's permission to do it.
I got it. So those filings would have had to been done in Esme Bianco's lawsuit, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was sitting here trying to think, you know, if it's something super delicious in it that she then controverted in her own suit, you know, could he go to the federal court and say, hey, I need the permission to be out from under this order for purpose of this because it's impeachable because she lied in this other court. And, you know, so there's always potential that, you know, if he needed it, he might be able to get it. if that were to happen, if she were to say something inconsistent. Hypothetically, she'd just say things consistent with what she said in Bianco's suit, so he wouldn't need it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, too, just because we don't know what they know, and we don't know what she said, and then 2 months later, it's settled. Now we can't even see a deposition, and that deposition will never see the light of day, as far as we know. Well, it seems that way anyways. So it would seem likely she would have to do a new deposition, right? And so they would already have a head start and know how she's going to answer or how to word things to get what she said before, I guess. And that's interesting to me because I really want to know what she said that, I mean, to me, I kind of wonder why the case, as maybe Bianco case settled so fast, but there's no way to really know. It's only a lot of speculation based on absolutely nothing. I would really like to know what was said just to see if there was any correlation there, but we're never going to get that. We're never going to know. So I will wear my tinfoil hat and not get that for now. So, but I would be interested to see if Walter's appeal is successful, then she has to do another deposition. Well, how is that going to maybe be used in Marilyn Manson's lawsuit? It just seems so weird, all these people and all these different cases with all these different depositions that either happen or don't happen. And then the main lawsuit continues.
Yeah. And you look at her case, if they finally get a court of appeals decision that reinstates her suit, then you've got to get discovery going and she's going to want it, or he's going to want it, but probably certainly she would want a confidentiality order because they've all asked for them. And then that would restrict the movement of the evidence across cases to some degree. You know, again, you can ask for relief and stuff like that. And, or you can say this, there is nothing confidential in this, judge, you know, that they're trying to hide things so that the truth won't get out. And you can argue about whether it's really confidential or not.
Yeah.
It depends on what is said in it. So yeah, that, you know, you're talking a long-term time frames again. Now we've got used to things happening almost every week, but it's back to, well, now this is 6 months from now and a year from now and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the only, you know, air quote exciting thing we have coming up is after the anti-slaps is a potential trial in October for Jane Doe in California. And you know, I mean, look at Esme Bianco's, her trial should have started in May or June and it was settled. And we don't know anything about the settlement except that, you know, Manson didn't have to say anything. Esme didn't have to say anything. Their lingo was basically the same, you know, wash our hands of this. And apparently it was an insurance payment, according to Howard Keenan, I guess, in an interview. Can you explain the significance, if anything, of that? If it's an insurance payment, does that matter in any sort of way?
Well, if you're going to say that out loud, the one reason why you might want to say it is what you're expressing there is, it's not like my guy had to write a check to admit his culpability, that this was a business decision by everybody involved, including the insurance company, because insurance companies, you're going to set up a reserve and they're looking at what they're having to pay, assuming they were doing that in this case, you know, paying the attorneys to defend the thing and their potential liability, and they want to get it off their books. And so they might say, well, look, can we make this kind of offer? And they discuss that with their insured and they, you know, they're trying to work it out. So that happens, you know, pretty frequently. Right. So
yeah,
that's, I guess, the significance of it is you have a party that certainly wasn't involved for or against Manson in terms of any actions. Right. That's an insurance company. So, you know, they have a business set of interest and no emotion in it. One way or the other. And it's just dollars and cents. You know, if we could give her X dollars, and then we're not going to have to pay the lawyers, you know, that much money and still potentially be liable at trial. And this thing could go, you know, go on forever. Let's close this out and move on with life. That makes sense for the insurance company, certainly.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So aside from the Doe case, you know, the one up in New York, I think that's going to, I would be surprised if Manson doesn't try and get the defendants to work with him and get it back up to federal court, because there was some real reason why he wanted it up there. Either way, he's going to attack this thing on a statute of limitations ground. And there, I did not think that the plaintiff has all the upside that Walters might have out in California. because of the nuances of the statute of limitations and the fact that she says the things happened, and I guess in Texas and Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So the obstacle she faces there is the fact she's not a resident there. New York has some restrictions. Like if you can't just use their new opened up window to go to New York and start filing lawsuits, because everybody in the country would then start filing lawsuits up there. So they have a rule that you have to also be inside the statute of limitations of the jurisdiction where the act happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is the case in Texas or Louisiana. I think the statute of limitations has run there. And also, I just don't think it's retroactive extraterritorially, they called it. So in other words, if it didn't happen in New York and you don't live here, you can't come here and use our statute of limitations to create litigation. I think mm-hmm. that's going to be his primary defense. And it'd be interesting to see what the plaintiff's attorneys have to say about it, because I think Manson's got a pretty strong legal theory there to defend himself.
Yeah, so I want to make sure I understand. So if they get it back to federal, would it be potentially the goal to get it in these other states that she makes these claims in?
That's a good point. So now there's two different things. When I'm talking about the statute of limitations, in theory, the state court and the federal court would apply that the same because it's state law. Mm-hmm. And these are state claims. So even if you're in federal court, the federal court is still going to apply state substantive law. Okay. They don't change the law there, so you don't have the forum shopping and all that. However, what was an interesting point was, if you do go to federal court, he could then potentially ask for a change of venue and say there is no real nexus with New York, District Court of New York. Like, the witnesses aren't here. I don't live here. She doesn't live here. It should be in this state. And really, yeah. any other state's better, because you know she wanted New York, right?
Yeah.
So get it to Texas or get it to Louisiana or something like that. And then that makes her case harder to deal with. So that is a benefit of going to federal court, is they can transfer cases all over the country because it's a federal system. So that would be a potential advantage, I suppose. But in theory, the actual law being applied, if it's up in New York, should stay the same whichever court it's in.
Yeah, so she would still be suing on the New York Adult Survivors Act. And I don't remember the lawsuit off the top of my head, but if she made a claim in various states, and one of them I think was New York and Syracuse or somewhere, I can't remember specifically, but I found it interesting that she did file in New York, being a Maryland resident now, with all these actions in different states, especially when all these new, you know, statute of limitations are going on everywhere. But I mean, I don't know, I guess she would have to prove that, right? That these events happened in New York, even though it seemed fleeting. I don't know.
Yeah. I wasn't even sure that allegedly the super bad stuff happened in New York. And just to go back and look at it again, I was thinking, you know, some of it obviously where it's in the other states, and some mm-hmm. of it was when she was a minor.
Yeah.
And that's a problem, because New York had a minor, a new window for minors, and that window has closed already. Mm-hmm. So for anything that occurred when you're a minor, you don't have all this retroactive stuff. So it doesn't even help for that. So it has to be the adult stuff. And then you still run into these other potential issues with the statute of limitations, depending on where the bad acts occurred. You certainly need something. You know, if all he did was, you know, say it was kind of mean or dismissive in New York, that's not really a suit there, right? Because yeah. I wasn't sure that she alleged in New York that she actually, you know, was assaulted there.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. That's why I'm kind of a little lost, because I know that lawsuit is lengthy. I think it's like 28 pages or yeah. maybe even more. And most of it, I'd say more than half of it, has to deal with Manson's former art, his lyrics, you know, Trent Reznor.
And that's why I say I think that was the worst suit against him, because it did have the minor allegations mm-hmm. in it, no. even if they're not really the central basis for the legal theory of the lawsuit, because the open window is the Adult Survivors Act. And that's mm-hmm. the one she actually quotes in her lawsuit, is the Adult Survivors Act. But, it, you know, if you're a pro-Manson, you view it as salacious. And if you're anti-Manson, you view it as the horror that he is. But what you say is true, which is most of her lawsuit is consumed with showing a lot of things that she say relates to minors, which she mm-hmm. was at one point when she interacted with him. So that's why, to me, it looked like the worst lawsuit in terms of the public narrative, but legally not the strongest one.
Right. So I believe I've asked this before, maybe for the podcast or maybe on YouTube, whether it's state or federal, do you think Manson would file an anti-SLAPP for this?
Yeah, so that is interesting legally, because they have an anti-SLAPP law in New York that's pretty strong. And I don't know that it would help Manson as much as it might the record companies, because the record companies, you know, published all this stuff. But it would, you know, it could potentially help all the defendants like Manson and the other ones. So they do have a thing like that. It's not going to help with the assault per se, or maybe the negligent security stuff. But what it would do is it stays discovery until it's resolved. And you know, it potentially limits the scope of the lawsuit. What's interesting is some federal courts consider that procedural law, not substantive. Because remember, I just said that if you go to federal court, they apply the substantive law of the state, but they apply their own procedural law. So the federal courts basically say, yeah, we'll do the negligence and stuff like that at the state, but nobody tells us how to handle our procedure. We have our own procedure. So if they consider a law procedural, they will do the federal version of that, not the state version. And I'm remembering now, because I think the Ninth Circuit in California, the courts say we consider anti-SLAPP substantive, so we'll allow it to be used in federal court. But mm-hmm. I think the circuit court for that controls New York has said, nah, it's procedural, and so you can't use it here. So I'm not sure that he could even use this. I'd have to look at my notes, because it's been such a long time since I looked at it. I was thinking he might actually lose the anti-SLAPP stuff there. Now, having said that, the gravamen of her complaint, the central core of her complaint, is assault. So the anti-SLAPP is not as important in her case as it is, say, for Wood Gore's defense, where Manson is saying, you know, that he suffered because of, in large part, what was said about him to other people and to the public, right? Mm-hmm. She's saying she was lured in by these things that were said, but the actual injury she suffered was due to the alleged assault and its effects on her, right? So I'm not sure that the striking, you know, the anti-SLAPP would be as good for Manson. So, you know, it might be cost benefit analysis. If you thought you could get this suit moved to Texas or something, it might be worth, you know, getting it moved to and not being able to use New York's anti-SLAPP.
So if let's say Manson doesn't respond with an anti-SLAPP, what is something he could respond with?
Well, he's going to have a motion to dismiss this thing on the statute of limitations, which is what he did in a Bianco case. Now, you know, what's weird about that is, if you remember in Bianco, he's filing these motions to dismiss and stuff. And also, I think in the Walters case, too, you notice usually the federal court will say, OK, cool motion to dismiss, bro. Now keep mm-hmm. doing the case and we'll get back to this motion to dismiss. That might be a year from now. Right. Mm-hmm. So that can be a downside of being in federal court, because usually in a state court, in my experience, if you file a motion to dismiss, you can go ahead and calendar it, right? And then you can get it decided. And if you're right, the case is over. But in federal court, they decide when they want to hear that motion to dismiss, and they'll just wait, like they did in the Bianco case. Remember, they even sent a scolding letter, I think, back.
Yeah, said, look, yeah, the we'll judge
did. It. Yeah, we'll get to it when we get to it. And then they got to it like a week later, but they had like their form letter of don't call us, we'll call you.
Yeah, it was a very strongly worded yeah. about how many cases they have in front of them.
Yeah. So from a slowing a case down defense standpoint, and not knowing all the variables off the top of my head, you know, being in state court, you could file a SLAPP thing, and that would slow the case down, and you do it in conjunction with a motion to dismiss. And that might hold the case off until you could actually get a judge to go, yeah, this doesn't, you're outside the statute of limitations, I'm going to dismiss it. And that could get more complicated in federal court. So I don't know all the motivations Manson had to go to federal court, although the moving the case was certainly potentially a good one, but he could have other reasons too.
Yeah, that sounds confusing, because my next question was going to be about, you know, if one did the anti-SLAPP and then if one did the motion to dismiss, and sounds like a big mess.
It is. Oh, yeah, it is. And, you know, like I think you just made this point, which is there's what, three defendants in the case, and they don't all have to file the same things.
Yeah. And I think there's like 1 to 20 unknown or yeah. whatever people, yeah. which I don't even know how they'll figure that out, if that's what they're alleging. But and that one really interests me, because when she filed as a Jane Doe, you know, we knew who she was based on her allegations, right? Mm-hmm. Well, now her name is attached to this. Well, I would think that would open her up to more of the scrutiny just because of what she has alleged previously and it not matching her lawsuit at all now. I would assume that Howard Kane would then, actually, I think he already has when they were already, before it went to federal court, maybe I'm wrong here, talked about the podcast and talked about her interview. So how could they use that moving forward? Could they include that in a motion to dismiss?
So normally in a case, a motion to dismiss early in a case is decided on the pleadings only. So you'll look at, like saying in Walter's case, you look at her lawsuit and you assume everything she says is true for purposes of the motion to dismiss. And then you tell the judge, if you, even if you took everything she said is true, here's a fatal problem with this case. The statute of limitations, or you don't allege an element of the cause of action, like in the Bianco, where the court threw out one of the Deftones because they said she didn't allege enough stuff about the injury of the contract or whatever. So usually a motion to dismiss, you don't bring any extraneous evidence. There's no affidavits. There's nothing like that. The anti-slap gets into a little bit of a hybrid because the state seemed to have this thing about the plaintiff needs to show that they have some evidence to support the claim. So that, so then you do get the sides throwing in a little evidence, but usually without discovery. Then later in the case, you have what's called a motion for summary judgment. And that usually occurs after the parties do all the discovery, depositions, exchanging documents and things. Then you go to the court and you say, judge, we've all been through all this stuff and they cannot support this one central thing that they have to have in their lawsuit to have a claim. You know, they're missing something here and they have no facts that show that there's even an issue for a jury to look at for this one thing. And then a judge will look at it and say, well, okay, there's no evidence that there was a contract or whatever. And then the case could be thrown out for that reason because no issue of material fact for some important part of the case. Those are usually hard to win, but that's when you would get into some of the other evidence and things like that. Now, what would happen is he would take her deposition and he would have all this podcast stuff, right? And prior statements and things. And then they would go through that in the deposition and get it all on the record. And he could then use it in a summary judgment motion later, or he could use it for impeachment of her in the case. Either, you know, directly through the deposition or just bring out the podcast thing and say, well, that's not what you said at this point, is it? And so it definitely could, you know, prior inconsistent statements by either party can be used against them in court.
Gotcha. So I guess my next question is, and I know we've talked about the anti-slap, if Manson responded with that. So basically, if Manson did want to include air quote evidence or whatever it is, declarations even, to kind of just get it out there for good PR, then probably choosing anti-slap might be good, right?
Yeah, and anti-slap seems to have this feature of it shuts cases down for a long time, you know, and it stops discovery. And since Manson's a defendant, you know, he'd like to stop discovery and he'd like to get the case dismissed. So, you know, who knows what's going on behind the scenes if the record companies are starting to gear up for defense. They'll all get together, all the defendants, which is fine because they have, you know, common interest in defeating the lawsuit. It's not wrong for the defendants to do that. And they'll come up with a theory. And it could be something like you said, where one of them files an anti-slap, the other one does this. They probably all have something to say on this, on the statute of limitations, for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not terribly sympathetic to her lawsuit in this case, but it's interesting because I read her attorney stuff online, you know, with as they, as they file different cases and things. I am sympathetic to bringing to account people who do bad things to kids, which is some of the cases they bring. So I don't think this is any kind of stellar case, in my opinion, based on the narrative that she laid out there. But that doesn't discredit the whole idea of, you know, bringing bad actors to justice.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I remember someone coming to me, and I don't know if this is true, so take it with a grain of salt. And I'm sure you could probably look it up if you wanted to. But someone told me that in the state of New York alone, Anderson Advocates has like 900 pending lawsuits in the state of New York. I'm like, are you sure?
That would not surprise me at all. If you've got a specialty in that and you manage to get you know, yourself out there in the media where people will come to you for this, they have, because I looked at it at some point and at the number of lawsuits filed in New York when they changed the statute of limitations was in the tens of thousands. So if they're a specialist in that we've got some lawyers in this state that have huge numbers of, or did, asbestosis kinds of claims.
Oh, okay.
Or certain kinds of, because they get known for it.
Yeah.
And then people start talking to each other and they're like, well, this lawyer's helping me with this. They know how to do this and stuff. And so all of a sudden that person has, you know, like a farm, or if you're, you know, if you want to discredit them, you call it a mill, and that's not necessarily fair, but they have a lot of cases of exactly the same type.